the news and issues from a superior point of view.
If you're a veteran, today's your day.
His voice graced Wisconsin's airwaves for 50 years, including on this program.
This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross, stumbling into your day.
We remember our colleague, Al Ross. But first, these happy hogs probably don't want to go to slaughter, and certainly not a 2.5-hour road trip to get there.
That means more trips to a butcher, because I can't also fit more than 9 hogs on my trailer at a time.
We'll learn how the shortage of meat inspectors is hurting our region's small and specialty farms. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. If it sounds like there's a menagerie going on here, there is. Those are hogs and a few chickens from the Will of the Winds farm near Washburn. Wisconsin may be America's dairy land, but its farmers raise beef cattle too, as well as hogs and other animals for meat. Increasingly, that farming is done by huge agribusinesses who have no trouble getting inspected by state and federal regulators. But for smaller specialty and organic farms, it's more difficult. A scarcity of inspectors work in more remote areas, and there's a similar lack of butchering operations. Some require ranchers to schedule appointments months before a calf or a piglet is born. One of those small farmers is Carly Stevenson, who runs the Will of the Winds farm with her husband near Washburn. She joins me to talk about the problem, along with Mark Abels Allison, the Bayfield County Administrator, who's been trying to get the state to increase inspections in our area. Welcome to Simply Superior, Carly and Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Robin.
So Wisconsin was built on family farms, I think I'm safe to say. Has it indeed switched to mainly agribusinesses? And if so, when did that happen?
I think it's happened over the past several decades. There's been a continuing growth in farm sizes. Bayfield County has seen it. Smaller farms that we had in years past have greatly diminished. Bayfield County used to have a very large dairy and beef cattle industry, and that's definitely declined in the past several decades.
Mm-hmm. Carly, tell us what you farm and what made you decide that you wanted to when so many people are leaving family farms.
Well, my husband and I raise hogs on pasture, and we're both actually first-generation farmers, and we've been going for about 7-8 years, and we started from scratch, and our initial inspiration for it was, or my inspiration was, I was a vegetarian for 5-8 years, and I wanted to eat meat, but I wanted to eat meat that was raised ecologically, healthily, that kind of a thing. And so we got into raising animals humanely, things like that, for ourselves and for our family, and found that we really loved it and love raising animals, being around animals.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a tremendous interest. I think over the past 10 years, the county has heard from farmers and residents really asking for assistance in specifically with livestock slaughter that requires state inspectors and state permitting. And I think it was just the kind of farms that Carly is talking about, is people want to support local agriculture. Certainly during COVID, we saw a huge increase in community interest in supporting local agriculture. And I think that trend was growing over the past several years. The issues are that it's very difficult. A local farmer has to travel hours and hours one way to take their cattle or their hogs or their chickens for slaughter. And we're trying to see if there aren't alternatives, or if the state can assist with either additional inspectors or butchers in our region.
How far do you have to travel, Carly? And my mind is going to old TV programs like Rawhide, right? And where we have a cattle drive going, you know, to Hinckley, Minnesota, or something like that.
Well, my first year up in Washburn, we traveled an hour and a half to Butternut, Wisconsin. And now I use a butcher in Sturgeon Lake, Minnesota, which is a 2.5 hour drive one way.
Well, I guess I was close when I flippantly said Hinckley. And I know you mentioned Minnesota because, as I understand it, you have to have a federal inspector look at the meat if you're going to sell it interstate, as opposed to a state inspector if you're selling it just within Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I joked about conjuring up the rawhide scene, but how do you travel and travel that distance with your animals?
We have a pickup truck, and then one of the first investments we had to make when we moved up here to Washburn was to buy a used livestock trailer. And so we have a regular hitch trailer where I can travel with up to 8-9 hogs at a time. But as our farm grows, that means more trips for me to a butcher because I can't also fit more than 9 hogs on my trailer at a time.
You're a little bit smaller than Archer Daniels Midland, I take it.
Yes.
In all seriousness, it's sort of like having a train that has one engine and takes a lot of power to run it, but it carries lots of cars. If you've got just one vehicle carrying, as you said, just a handful of hogs, it's going to cost you a lot to in gas to go back and forth if you had 20 hogs.
Yeah, precisely.
Well, that's illustrating the problem. We're speaking with Carly Stevenson of Will of the Winds Farm, which she runs with her husband near Washburn, and Mark Abels Allison, the Bayfield County Administrator, who's been trying to get the state to increase inspections in our area. We're talking about the lack of inspectors working in more remote areas such as ours, as well as an unavailability of butchering operations. I mentioned earlier the large agribusinesses who are producers who both raise the animals and slaughter them if in a different location or branch of the same company. And I assume because of their large volume, take up most of the resources and human power of the inspectors.
Yeah, and I'm no meat expert, but I'm trying to share what we've heard from both our county board supervisors and residents is that these smaller farms have smaller volumes, and so it's difficult for them to get their stock scheduled for slaughter. But secondarily, I think, is that there are fewer butchers or slaughterhouses in the area. We have excellent facilities right now, but it's not as many as we've had in the past. And there's some concern that once somebody retires, that there may not be a succession plan. And so we could have even fewer local or regional harvesters.
Mm-hmm.
And I would agree with that because I think part of it is that butchering is not a beautiful business. And it's not a very attractive career for many people to want to jump into. And for myself as a business, I'm looking for somebody who has experience too. So it's harder to even support any beginning butchers off the ground because I have a quality of meat that I need to maintain as I'm doing farmers markets and on farm sales and et cetera. To find someone who not only is interested in that career path, but as well has that background and or resource and understanding of how to successfully complete it.
We're speaking with Carly Stevenson, who runs Will of the Winds Farm with her husband near Washburn, and Mark Abels Allison, the Bayfield County Administrator, who's been trying to get the state to increase inspections in our area. We're talking about the lack of inspectors working in more remote areas, as well as the unavailability of butchering operations. And I want to go to those two issues to make them clear here. It's inspections and processing. So one of them is the government's responsibility. Right, of state and federal, depending on where you're selling your meat. And the other is free enterprise, perhaps. As you just said, Carly, people who either want to become butchers or not, we can't tell people what they should be doing with their lives. So is it the government's fault if there aren't enough meat processors?
I think there's a role that the state can play in assisting processors in our region and encouraging them. You know, one very bright example of that was the meat and poultry supply chain resiliency grant that the state just released. And they did, I think, nearly 100 grants across the state of Wisconsin. And that's good. That's encouraging and supporting our meat processors to make innovations and to continue to be strong. Of note, however, is that unfortunately, there were, I don't know if there weren't any applications or there weren't any, there weren't any grant announcements for the 14 counties in northern Wisconsin, I think Douglas County being the exception to that, but from east to west, the northern tier of the state either didn't apply or didn't receive a grant. And that's of concern. You know, as Carly stated earlier, there's an interest and there's a market for local meat and for communities that want to be resilient and be able to respond in times of adversity, that local supply is and processing ability is really important.
Mm-hmm. And Carly, what does that lack of processing facilities mean to you? I said in my intro, it could be years, years ahead of the time your piglet or your calf is born that you have to schedule the processing?
Yes, for us, I usually call the butcher in around, say, January, February. And already on their website, they say that they're already full, but that thankfully, for me at least, is only related to any beef cattle. But I was able to fill in some slots for December for my hogs, where these piglets aren't even born until April or so. And so I'm having to create butcher slots for like
for imaginary piglets. Yes, they're imaginary pigs. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and so it can be very stressful. I'm pretty stressed when I go to the butcher's website and they say they're full. And I'm like, oh, no. But I have to just anticipate roughly how many hogs I'm going to be able to even find for feeder piglets and things of that respect. And just hope that we can fill it in. And it becomes a conundrum because when we first began, we used to be able to see our hogs were growing through a summer season and call up the butcher in August and say, okay, I think like one more month, one at, you know, 6 weeks, we're going to be good to go in on our preem weight. And now I have to make butcher dates in late November, December, and just hope that the hogs will be large enough. But most of the time they're overly large, but I have to still keep them. And so I'm losing money because then they're eating so much more feed than I had budgeted and things of that respect. So I'm also like, it's a struggle for the farm.
And what about the inspection? How does that work physically? You know, how far do you have to take people or do they come to you or?
All of the inspections for me are done at the butcher directly. And so when I make dates, the hogs are slaughtered. For me, they're slaughtered on a Friday. And then the inspector comes out those Fridays, and the butcher does all of that communication directly with the certifiers.
Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a time where the inspector simply wasn't available?
I don't believe that's been an issue for me.
Okay, good. Let's keep it not being an issue for you. Mark, have you heard of that, though, happening to you know, other operations, other farmers?
No, not to my knowledge. I think what Carly described, I think, is the case, is that you schedule the processing date and then the inspection takes place. That's coordinated, I think, at the processor.
And I also was just going to say that I think there's a little bit of leeway. So, you know, if my butchering is on a Friday and the inspector is unable to make it, a lot of times those animals have to hang for days, or in cattle's case, I think cattle have to hang for at least over a week. And so it has a little bit more of a leeway time if the inspector can't make it that day, because I believe it just needs to be inspected prior to being cut up.
So, Mark, you've had a proposal that's gone down to the state in part of Superior Days. What were you asking for?
Well, we're asking for a number of considerations, but I think some of the most important are assisting with succession planning and new harvester establishments, supporting smaller scale harvesters. I think that's one focused area. And we spoke earlier about the state's meat processing resiliency grant program. And we think things like that are positive to help encourage. Obviously, they're not sustaining any operation, but it creates additional support, incentives, capacity for existing and potentially new operations in our region. So we're trying to raise the issue, let the state know that our smaller meat processors are important to our region, and we're trying to work collaboratively with both the local business and the state to make sure they're viable businesses in the years ahead.
And Carly, what's the best case scenario for you?
Not have to travel 2.5 hours. honestly, I think just even be able to support other small businesses who want to invest in processing and have training and knowledge of processing, especially with hogs. It's a pretty close tied relationship because I'm getting meat smoked, I'm getting meats turned into sausages, things of that respect. So I'm paying a lot of attention to the recipes and the ingredients my processors are using. And so just trying to find somebody who wants to put attention into that detail and has that knowledge to take the efforts I produce into raising wonderful pigs and make sure that that byproduct becomes amazing pork.
Well, that's a perfect segue to my last question here is, tell us about your amazing pork. I want you to indeed give us a commercial because, you know, if most people just go to the store and they go to the meat counter and something looks pretty good and it's got a USDA seal on it and everything sounds great and everything, you buy it and it's cheap and you bring it home and you feed your family. But what's special about Will of the Winds products?
Mm-hmm. Our Will-o'-the-Winds pigs are raised completely full-time on pasture, and we also feed only certified organic grains. So with our meat, we're committing to no GMOs. We don't use any antibiotics because we raise our hogs proactively on pasture versus having to be more retroactive and giving any animals antibiotics, things of that respect, because we're looking at our farm as a whole. And so we also pasture rotate our hogs. We plant cover crops, garden produce, things of that respect. So they're getting the best of the best all year long. And then we take that pork product and I sell at 2 farmers markets through the summer, as well as next year we'll be developing a farm store directly on our farm where people will be able to come out and purchase our goods, both here and at market.
And one more time, let's hear those happy, healthy hogs. I have to wonder, where did you grow up, and did you ever think you'd be a hog farmer, a pig farmer?
Not at all.
An organic, natural pig farmer at that.
Yeah. No, I grew up southwest of the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and my brother-in-law's family actually are farmers, but they are conventional row croppers and growing field corn and soybeans. And to me, that's what I thought farming was. And my husband, while going to Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin, which is why we fell in love with this community we now live in. And that was when I realized there was more to it. There's more to helping our planet besides doing conventional row crops. And I also work for Marble Seed. It used to be known as Moses, the Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Service. And so I had the opportunity to meet organic farmers, get to understand more of how we can farm better, we can farm more responsibly, and as well as supporting our own families while we do that.
All right. We've been speaking with Carly Stevenson, who runs Will of the Winds Farm with her husband near Washburn, and Bayfield County Administrator Mark Abels Allison. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
Coming up, we remember Al Ross.
This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross, stumbling into your day with news. Days are growing shorter, nights are getting long. Soon the autumn leaves will fall, just like in the song. And when the leaves are on the ground, a choice I'll have to make. Do I use the big old blower or be a man and use the rake?
Welcome back to Simply Superior, and yes, this is Simply Superior. That was the voice of Al Ross introducing Spectrum West, our arts and culture sister show from WPR's Eau Claire Bureau. We're remembering Al today, who passed away at 73 on October 21st after a brief battle with cancer. Al hailed from Neenah, Wisconsin, and after attending broadcasting school in Milwaukee, spent 50 years in radio, the last 14 with WPR. As host of Spectrum West, he interviewed everyone in the arts who was remotely connected to or visiting western or northwest Wisconsin, and we were delighted to include many of those conversations on this show. Al's guests included the very famous, as well as someone who might just be a guitar picker down the road from you, and just happened to be a Grammy winner as well. Al spoke with all of them as if they were his next-door neighbors, from whom he was borrowing a cup of sugar, and I'm not sure he didn't ask them for one. Here are excerpts from a few of those interviews, beginning with internationally best-selling novelist Nicholas Butler, who indeed was one of Ross's neighbors down the road.
This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Very nice to have you along. Nicholas Butler just watched book number 5 hit the shelves. It's an absorbing novel called Godspeed, a title that will be defined as you pore over the pages of descriptive, enticing prose. A couple days ago, we sat on his rural Eau Claire County porch, chickens and roosters in the live audience.
I do believe that you could tell our audience in a concise manner what this book is about. I'm afraid that if I tried, I might be a spoiler in some ways. So have at it.
It's basically about three guys who own a small construction firm in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And they are approached by a mysterious woman who wants them to finish the construction of her architecturally significant house in a very short amount of time. And if they do so, they will be rewarded handsomely with the big reward. Yeah.
Here we go. Atmosphere. Ambiance. Okay, folks, you now know we're outside. I read the book surprisingly fast for me. Yes, I wanted to find out what happened, but also, yes, I wanted to get you scheduled for this interview as quickly as I could. Must be time to get up. I realize an underlying purpose of doing an interview is publicity, so let me get my endorsement out of the way. It's a good book. I think you'll like it. Pick it up. Other endorsements are much more flowery, and they come from literary peers. You'll read them on the jacket of the book. This book is about a deadline, actually in more ways than one, including mortality. Tell our audience, because I found this interesting, and I didn't know it until after I was done reading the book, what you put yourself through to actually feel the pressure that your characters were feeling.
Yeah, back in 2019 when I was writing the book, I basically put myself on the same deadline as the characters in the book. So I had about 5, maybe 6 months to write the book, which for some writers, maybe it's easy for them to write a book in 5, 6 months. For me, it wasn't very easy. It's not my normal pace. We have 2 small kids, and at the time I was promoting my last book. So it was just frenetic. It was writing every time I had a chance, including, you know, in the pickup line at school to get my kids or during their swim practice. And yeah, it was maybe not the most pleasant writing experience for me, but I think it allowed me to achieve what the characters were going through. Yeah.
I think you did. Many people listening are already Nick Butler fans. To those who are not yet in the fan club, I'm curious as to what's happened to your writing over the course of 5 books. Have you noticed anything that's happened to your writing? And are you surprised by anything?
I don't know. I mean, I think for me, I'm just trying to find new challenges. This is a different book for me. It's not based in Wisconsin. It's more of like a literary thriller, which is not something I've ever tackled before. But I thought part of being an artist was trying new things and trying to keep things fresh and trying to, you know, better your craft. And so that's what I was doing here. In terms of the writing, I don't know. I mean, I think as you mature as a person, I guess I hope my perceptions are maturing a little bit.
I got to mention another phenomenon that happens to me. When I read a new book of yours, I forget details of the previous book. I recall the plots, but that's about it. Some may say that's a deficiency, but I say it's a compliment to your writing because what I'm absorbing is formidable. Do you find that weird? I mean, I've read all your books, but I don't remember them much. I remember the latest one.
Yeah, I think that's okay, Al.
Is it okay?
I don't need therapy of any kind.
No, I think that's fine. Well, I mean, I read a lot of books every year, and it's funny, like, even the most impactful books, I only have ultimately a superficial recall of what was going on. I think that's pretty normal.
You can tell people that you read that book and it was really good, but if they ask you stuff.
Yeah.
Good.
I think you're okay.
Good. That's what I needed. Appreciate it. I have to take issue, though, however, on page 187 of the book, you describe being 70 years old as rusty and cranky, and as one in that vicinity. I want to make sure that people understand that that's a generalization that's not always true.
I would say specifically here in this setting, cranky is an accurate description at times, wouldn't you, Al?
But rusted.
Rusted? You seem sprightly, spry.
Keep going.
I'm not going to keep going.
This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Chamber music features the people in an ensemble. There are less of them, so their role is enhanced. And when one is out front as a soloist, well, you don't get there unless you've reached a remarkable level. And only by accepting and completing remarkable training. That's the story of Eunice Kim, a young instrumentalist who began before many and surpassed most along the way. A native of the San Francisco area and graduate of the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, today she's a member of the prestigious St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. She'll be accompanied by, and will accompany at times, the Eau Claire Chamber Orchestra. I research a lot of people and websites in my line of work, and I must say that your research was extra enjoyable. It was good stuff to read, and the visuals from photos to videos were equally delightful. Photos in your website gallery have you playing with a classical guitarist, a string quartet, a promo photo of you in front of a rusty tractor. I thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah.
And a great shot of you mentally bonding with your instrument. Speaking of the size of the instrument, you began your relationship with the violin at age 6.
Right.
The road from 6 to sensational, that had to be kind of a fast lane, because I read, and I didn't just read because I found the video, your first solo performance was at the age of 7. Yeah, my practical side would assume that your age 7 performance was something like Mary Had a Little Lamb, but since it was with the Korean Broadcasting Symphony Orchestra, it was something more. And as I said, there is a video out there of that performance. First of all, be honest, how often do you watch that video?
I don't like to watch that video, but I have friends who bring it up occasionally, and, you know, it's a fun party video to embarrass me.
Yeah, well, so what were you playing there?
I was playing Vivaldi Concerto, I believe, A minor. It was a fun experience, and I remember finishing that and enjoying that moment so much of just thinking, I just made music with, you know, all these people on stage, and everyone out there in the audience is here to listen, and that is so cool. I wonder if I could do that for the rest of my life. That would be so amazing. And, I do remember that one moment. I don't actually remember playing the piece.
No. Here's something that I noticed. Your facial expression was so intense in that video, but I got to tell you that at about the 2 minute and 23-second point of the video, you glance at the audience, and first to your left, and then a bit to your right, and you must have seen someone familiar, because your face at that point brightens, and you crack just a bit of a smile, and you...
Oh, my gosh.
You dive back
That's
in.
Great.
Any idea whose encouraging face you might have seen?
I did.
look out to the audience quite a few times because my grandparents were sitting right in the front row. You know, that was the first time they had really seen me play the violin ever because they live in Seoul, Korea, and I lived in San Francisco. So that was really the first time they watched me play, and I think they were excited for me, and I was excited that they were able to come see me, and I had my cousins in the row behind them, and yes, my parents were there, and it was just such a fun gathering of family, and I do remember glancing over at them quite a few times.
Yeah. I noticed it instantaneously.
Oh.
There was that grandma look.
Yeah.
A look that only a grandma can bring on, I think.
Yeah. Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
We were poor, 11 kids. I had 11 kids in my family. I was 10th. I just slid out. I was home before my mom from the hospital, so.
Louis Anderson is a household name in comedy. 30-plus years on the big stage will do that. He's also been on the big screen, the smaller screen, within hit shows like Life with Louis, Family Feud, and his current role on the FX hit Baskets. But his first love is stand-up comedy, and he'll be standing on the stage of the Mabel Tainter Theater in Menominee. We talked with the Minnesota native earlier this week as he fought off the final stages of a cold, caught, he believes, on the set of Coming to America 2, which he just completed.
I shook a lot of hands and said hi to a lot of people.
Can't have too much hand sanitizer for that.
Yeah, but you know, when you're in the middle of it, you know, the hand sanitizing in some ways seems rude. How's everything going?
Oh, good. The last time you and I talked, we talked about Tim Harmston and Mary Mack.
Yeah.
Their wedding and stuff. That was fun.
Yeah, they're great people.
Yeah, they are. Congratulations on that Coming to America, too. That's cool.
Yeah, that was a really nice surprise, you know, to get that call and say, hey, will you do it? And I said, will I? Yeah, that was 30 years coming. People have been asking me, when are you going to do another Coming to America? It was a lot of fun.
I have forever loved Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and I didn't have any idea you were in it.
Yeah, I'm a quick blink.
Yeah.
I heard they're going to try and do another one.
All these sequels. They're good movies, so why not, huh? Well, it appears you and I haven't talked since October of 2012, and when you get to be our age, you know, you simply can't lop off seven-year chunks at a time. It goes fast enough as it is, so...
Yeah, that's true.
So let's plan on speaking more often, okay?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, congratulations. Since we last spoke, you have taken home some hardware, an Emmy, and a Critics' Choice Award for Best Supporting Actor. That was neat.
Yeah, that is a cool thing.
I watched the YouTube videos of those wins. As impressive as they are, I have to comment on your formal wear because you seem to have some wonderful neck brooches that you wear, kind of blingy in a way. How much Minnesota is left in Louis Anderson? Does it ever get replaced?
I'll tell you a great story about the first brooch. I was in Baskets. The first AD, Sally Sulander, who's a great first AD for assistant director, you know, she says, oh, my mom loves you. And I said, oh, how is your mom? You know, she's good. I said, you should call her. You should give your mom a call and tell her I said hi. And she did. And shortly after that, her mom died.
Oh, boy.
And that brooch, that was her mother's brooch.
Yeah, you had two different ones on, I noticed. One at the Emmys and one at the Critics' Choice.
Yeah, and the other one was one of my mom's pieces of jewelry. So they were really more sentimental. And I also hate those neckties. You know, those are two pieces that were really from one mother and one was from another. And with me playing a mother, I just felt like they were appropriate.
I see that season 4 of Baskets is airing as we speak, and it's legendary that the other Louis C.K. and Zach cast you to play a matronly woman. Have they ever told you where that notion came from, that you'd be good at that?
Well, Zach said he had a sound, you know, for the mother, and he went, and Louis said, you mean Louis Anderson? And Zach said, yeah, and Louis said, should we call him? And they called me.
And
it's
you
a
said,
good
yeah.
Story, and it's true, you know. The director was there. Everybody was there.
And you had such a wonderful role model in Orizella Anderson, and it just took off from there. Way to go. I was going to bring up the fact that you truly have become a well-rounded entertainer. You have done stand-up. You've been successful in an animated series. You've had movie and TV roles. And you're an author. And I was about to end it by saying the only thing that's left is music. And I was going to say, are you saving that for a big finish?
You know, I have toyed with the idea of doing an album as Christine Baskett.
Oh, yeah.
Love songs by Christine Baskett.
Well.
Our love songs and ballads, maybe, huh?
Yeah.
You know, my dad was a musician, so I know there's some talent in me.
What did he play?
He was a trumpet and cornet player for Hoagy Carmichael.
Wow.
Hoagy came to our house once, and my dad was too embarrassed because we lived in the projects. It was pretty embarrassing. But, you know, I think I get some of my talent, certainly, from him.
Yeah. Louis Anderson on the phone with us.
Deep in these woods, we find a shack, all wrapped in tar paper. It's hot outside, but the shack looks cold and empty, like I feel inside. You never know what treasures we'll find, says Mum. In the shack, we don't see any treasures. Wooden table, empty crates, rusty oven, dusty shelf, potbelly stove, box springs. But Lowell and Eva find a door in the floor. Below is a root cellar filled with old glass jars, a tin pail, a pile of rags, and a pitcher pump that goes up and down, and out comes a stream of cool, clear water. This place will do fine, says my big brother Ray, but it doesn't seem like much of a home to me.
Eliza Wheeler is the author and illustrator, and the newest book is Home in the Woods. She's from West and Northwest Wisconsin, folks, born and raised in Solon Springs. When one reads your bio, it's almost a whiplash moment when one sees the quote, she is from Northern Wisconsin, Los Angeles, and now lives in Minneapolis. I mean, that is a Dagwood sandwich, I got to tell you. A little bit of everything. I have read about the bucolic upbringing you had in the North Woods, picking blueberries, skipping through the woods. Then there was a buffer in the fact that you went to Menominee for some stout schooling. But then you found yourself in Los Angeles doing graphic design, but you didn't like working on a computer, so that's my setup. Assuming there was a little bit of culture shock between Solon Springs and Los Angeles.
That's for sure. Yeah, Menominee, though, felt like a pretty big town. That was a good little introduction to traffic lights. And yeah, so going to Menominee was nice. I went to school for graphic design.
Yeah, you liked art as a high school student and
yeah,
as a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. Just, you know, grew up drawing nonstop. Mm. I think when I was getting ready to go to college, I didn't really know the difference between different art forms and practice in terms of what a profession would be like. And so graphic design felt like sort of natural in terms of finding something that I could do that was artistic and become employed.
That's always the thing when it comes to art.
Exactly. It's
you
the trick, right?
You have to find a facet of it that's employable.
Yep.
Because
so,
a starving artist is not what you want to be.
It's not the best. Yeah. It's romantic in theory, but in practice is pretty hard.
Now, there is a quote in one of the reviews on the back of the dust cover of your new book. You are said to have, quote, an intuitive knowledge of what the world looks like to a very small person.
I love that quote. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's one of the biggest compliments I've ever gotten from a reviewer. And I think maybe what makes children's illustrations such a natural fit for me as an artist is that I just still have very vivid visual memories of what childhood was like. Now I realize growing up in rural northern Wisconsin, it was a really special time and place because I grew up in this tiny town. Lots of land to roam around. I lived surrounded by my grandparents and cousins, and so we just had a lot of space to play.
Eliza Wheeler is the author and illustrator, and the newest book is Home in the Woods. She's from West and Northwest Wisconsin, folks, born and raised in Solon Springs. I bet you the people there and people here are awfully proud of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Al.
And those were excerpts from some of the hundreds of interviews by our WPR colleague, the late Al Ross. A celebration of life will be held for Al tomorrow, Saturday, November 5th, at the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls, from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. It's followed by another in his hometown of Neenah next Thursday, November 10th, at the Whiting Boathouse. Coming up, the regional news and review.
I'm Al Ross. Thanks, thanks, thanks for putting Spectrum West into your day. Enjoy.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And I should say welcome back after your much-deserved vacation last week, because the news didn't stop while you were away, and there was a significant development in the fatal car crash involving outgoing state senator Janet Buley.
Yes, a series of reports released by the Wisconsin State Patrol detail that a driver was traveling at 100 miles an hour seconds before colliding with a vehicle driven by Wisconsin State Senator Janet Buley in a July crash in Ashland. The crash killed the driver of the speeding vehicle, 27-year-old Alyssa Ortman of Clearfield, Pennsylvania, and her 5-year-old daughter, Kalesa Fink. Buley pulled out from a public beach in Ashland to turn east onto Highway 2 shortly before 12:30 p.m. on July 22, when her car collided with the car driven by Ortman that was heading west. A third vehicle, driven by Jody Munson of Washburn, was heading east when Ortman's car spun across the highway and struck it. Now, data pulled from Ortman's 2019 Honda Civic show that she was traveling at 100 miles an hour, and she had applied the brake at that speed. Within 2.5 seconds of applying the brake, the crash occurred and her vehicle slowed to 5 miles per hour, according to the data. Buley had no alcohol in her system at the time of the crash, according to a toxicology report. A vape pen was found with Ortman at the hospital, and that was possibly believed to contain Delta 8 THC, which is derived from hemp and is legal in Wisconsin. The records also included a 67-minute long interview between Buley and Sergeant Michael Marquardt. In the interview, Buley said that she was on the phone with a reporter during the crash. Buley also said that she had a cataract removed from her eye the morning before the crash, but that the procedure improved, not inhibited, her vision. Described in the moment before the crash, Buley said she saw two black vehicles coming towards her, but figured they were far enough away at the speed limit posted of 45 miles an hour. So she felt she had time to pull out of the parking lot and cross the lanes. Buley said that I barely got a foot and pow, I got hit. Ashland County District Attorney David Meany said that he is determining whether he has all the investigative reports for this incident. Once he determines he has everything he needs, he'll decide whether to file charges. Now, earlier this month, Brandon Fink of Pennsylvania, who is the father of Kalesa Fink, filed a wrongful death suit in Ashland County Circuit Court against Buley, Munson, and three insurance companies in response to the fatal crash. The lawsuit seeks damages of more than $10,000. The responding parties have 45 days to respond to the complaint. Fink is requesting that the case be tried by a 12-person jury.
All right, that is a significant development. On the Minnesota side, there are some developments happening with police, or as they're called, the resource officers in the public schools in Duluth.
Yes, a new contract between school and city officials that governs the placement of responsibilities of in-school police officers includes many changes called for by a group of Duluth public school leaders. School board and city councilors inked a new agreement this fall that outlines their school resource officer program, which places one Duluth Police Department officer apiece at Denfeld High School, East High School, Lincoln Park Middle School, and Ordean East Middle School. The new contract is valid through the end of the 2022-2023 school year. It compels the district to pay the department $296,000, a figure that's about $19,000 higher than the one spelled out this past summer that covered the previous school year. But the cost is relatively low in a list of objections skeptics and opponents of the program have raised. They note that students of color are disproportionately cited by officers stationed in the schools. Data shows non-white students are cited by school resource officers more often than white students. Proponents of the program argue that it helps keep students and school and staff safe, a concern that's often heightened after a shooting at a U.S. school. Unlike earlier versions of the agreement, the new agreement now explicitly calls for police stationed at a Duluth public school to participate in school meetings and training as if they were a staff member, and to review data at their assigned school about criminal acts every month or quarter. It also calls for yearly evaluations of the program, for the city's police chief to assign and hire those officers with input from principals, and for those principals to collaborate with city staff on annual performance reviews of each officer assigned to a school.
All right. Well, moving to the business district, might there be changes with the police and the environment in general in downtown Duluth?
Yes. Mayor Emily Larson's downtown task force announced its recommendations for safety, activation, vision, and investment during a news conference on Tuesday at Minnesota Surplus and Outfitters. The visible change with an increase in blighted properties, increasing homelessness, low use of indoor and outdoor sidewalks, and overall public safety issues had caught the concern of community members and business leaders, prompting the need for the task force's creation. On the topic of crime, the report calls for the addition of a city prosecutor filling vacant police positions and the continuation of the city's embedded outreach within the downtown Duluth organization. It also stresses an increased focus on repeat offenders and prioritizing mental health response. Better communication and coordination among police, stakeholders, and the public is also prioritized, with attention to housing needs and addressing public encampments. The task force also calls for better lighting, including a storefront improvement incentive program to help business owners, as well as addressing ongoing permitting concerns. They want the city to assess the skywalk system and the current need for downtown parking. Now, the 15-member task force is comprised of business and nonprofit leaders, government staff, and officials from the city of Duluth and St. Louis County. It has been meeting to examine the needs of downtown Duluth since appointed by the mayor in late April. Members of the downtown task force will be invited to meet quarterly to ensure it is on track, experiencing progress, and adjusting course as needed.
And finally, our hometown Hollywood star is still dancing into our hearts and dancing with the stars.
Yes, he is. And despite missing a day of rehearsal due to illness, Daniel Durant prevailed on Halloween night in the Disney Plus reality competition show Dancing with the Stars. Durant and his dance partner, Britt Stewart, were the first couple declared safe, putting them among the eight couples still in competition. That means Durant now faces fewer than half of the celebrities originally challenging him for the Mirror Ball trophy. The Duluth actor came up with a concept for the couple's dance, which involved the pair dodging zombies in a battle scene inspired by video games played to Billie Eilish's Bury a Friend. Stewart and Durant will dance again for a 1990s themed Dancing with the Stars episode Monday at 7 o'clock on the streaming service Disney Plus.
All right, we'll all be watching that. I mentioned you were on vacation. You cut your teeth in sports reporting, so did you head east to hit the first game of the World Series?
Well, I didn't hit the World Series, but I came close. Got to visit the Cooperstown Baseball Hall of Fame for the first time, and really enjoyed seeing all the memorabilia and the plaques and the shrinies, and really just dug into baseball for a day, and it was kind of a nice treat while the World Series was getting underway.
All right. Well, maybe we can look forward to some more local entries. Unfortunately, not from any of our local teams for this year's performance. So we've been joined by Rick Lovers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with one more tribute to Al Ross, with music from one of his most frequent guests, Grammy-winning finger-picker guitarist Pat Donahue, who makes his home right here in our region. We'll let Al do the introduction. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Can read all about him, buy some stuff, follow his live escapades online at patdonahue.com. And here is the previously mentioned one guy on one guitar playing Peter Gunn.
comes a big finish. That is amazing. One guy, one guitar. Come on. Come on. People don't do that.